Bill said he wanted passionately to pursue a certain new project, but he said he couldn't do it because of pressure from his company, his wife, and others. He said they could not afford to have him take the several months necessary to work on the new idea. As he described the new project, I could tell it was clearly in his zone of genius. I counseled Bill to do whatever it took to make it happen, even if he could only spend an hour a day laying the groundwork for it. At the end of the session, he told me he was going to try, I put that in quotes, quote, try to find that hour a day, but I could tell by the look on his face that it was unlikely to occur. He told me he'd call me in a month to schedule a second appointment, quote, when things slowed down a little. Unfortunately, it was our last conversation because Bill died of a massive heart attack a few weeks later. I've replayed that hour with him in my mind more times than I can count. Bill was seemingly in perfect health. His wife was a yoga teacher, and they were both devoted to a healthy lifestyle. I've always wondered if there was a way in which I could have been more forceful with him in helping him make a life-changing and possibly life-saving commitment to his zone of genius. I'll never know, but from that experience, I made a commitment to myself to do everything I could to spend more time in my own zone of genius, and to make a passionate case to everyone I care about to do the same. Given the right tools and a little wisdom, we can learn to heed our call to genius, sparing ourselves the unpleasant consequences of plugging our ears to keep from hearing it. I want to show you how to establish yourself in your zone of genius, beginning with a modest investment of 10 minutes a day and culminating in spending upwards of 70% of your time expressing your true genius in the world. I hit the 70% mark in the mid-90s and rebirthed myself at midlife into a previously unimaginable degree of success in love, financial abundance, and creativity. That's what I want for you. If that's what you want for you, you will find the precise tools here for identifying your natural genius and expressing it in the world. Making the leap, dismantling the foundation of the problem. There's something important you should know about the upper limit problem. When you attain higher levels of success, you often create personal dramas in your life that cloud your world with unhappiness and prevent you from enjoying your enhanced success. This is the upper limit problem at work. In other words, the upper limit problem crosses the boundaries of money, love, and creativity. If you make more money, your upper limit problem may kick in and create a situation that causes unhappiness, ill health, or something else that blocks your enjoyment of your enhanced money supply. If you meet and marry the love partner of your dreams, your upper limit problem may kick in and cause setbacks in your financial life. In short, you have a tendency to follow big leaps forward in your success with big mess-ups. These mess-ups rubber band you back to where you were before, or sometimes someplace worse. Fortunately, though, if you see what you're doing in time, you can shift right out of the free fall and point yourself back up toward the sky. See if any of these scenarios sound familiar. You make a big financial surge forward, such as a big stock market win or something else that causes a meaningful financial change. Almost before you've had a chance to celebrate, an argument or an illness or some other negative occurrence throws a wet blanket on the good feelings. Here's another scenario. You're feeling close to your love partner. Perhaps you're sitting together quietly, sipping a glass of your favorite wine. Seemingly out of nowhere, an argument sparks into flame. The close feelings disappear. You're embroiled in a conflict that stretches into hours or maybe even days. Here's another scenario. You're sitting alone in your office or your living room. You feel happy and at ease. Suddenly your mind swerves and plunges into a stream of negative thoughts. Seconds later, you're obsessing about the awful condition of the world or focusing on the dreadful color of your carpets. Let me give you a more specific example. I assisted a powerful, wealthy businesswoman in making a breakthrough in the area of romantic relationships. In her mid-50s, when I worked with her, Lois told me in her first session that she could do, quote, just about anything well except stay married. Twice divorced and now single for 5 years, she despaired of finding and keeping a good relationship. She even recited statistics. Her odds of being captured by terrorists were better than her chances of finding love at her age. Lois was quite stubborn and clinging to her views, so it took us a few sessions to unwind the set of limiting beliefs she clung to around the availability of men. Finally, though, she realized that it didn't matter if men were scarce, because all she needed was one. In a pivotal session, she made a firm, heartfelt commitment to attracting and keeping a healthy, loving relationship with a man. At the beginning of the following week, she called to cancel the next session. She said she had met a wonderful man 2 days after our last session and had spent the most romantic weekend of her life with him. She thanked me for helping her make the shift and said she didn't need any more help. I gently suggested that this was just the time maybe she should come in. I explained that while breakthroughs are important and thrilling, it's the subsequent stabilization and integration of the breakthrough into daily life that really allows the changes to become permanent. She listened politely and then said, thank you, and then hung up without making another appointment. Well, about 6 months later, I got an urgent message to call her. When I reached her, I could hardly understand her because she was talking so fast. I invited her to slow her breathing down a little bit, which helped her get her anxiety dialed down to a level at which she could communicate clearly. She told me that her new husband, the man she'd spent the glorious weekend with the last time I'd spoken to her, had counseled her on an investment that had lost over $200,000 virtually overnight. He'd had some, quote, inside information on a stock that was supposed to go up and instead went down. The sure thing that was going to double her money overnight instead wiped it out completely. What should I do, she asked me. Should I throw him out or leave the relationship or... I said, wait a minute, hold on. Has he ever done anything like this before? No, she said. So I asked, well, what's his behavior been like over the past few months? She said, wonderful. I've never been happier in my life until this happened. And then I asked her an important question. I said, what does he do for work? She said, he's a software designer. He consults for different high-tech companies. And I said, so does he make a good living doing that? She said, pretty good, but he's kind of a frugal person. He doesn't need a huge income. So let me ask you a question, I said. What gave you the idea you should take investment advice from him? There was a long silence. Finally, she said, oh, my God. I said, what's happening? She said, I just realized that I love him so much, it never occurred to me that he was flawed. I asked her to reconsider the judgment that he was flawed. I said, you know, he may not be necessarily flawed. You're the savvy business person who chose to take investment advice from a software designer. In the ensuing silence, I could almost hear Lois's teeth grinding. Finally, she said, damn you, you're right. And do you know how many times in my life I've said that? I hazarded a guess. Never? Again, she uttered the magic phrase, you're right, zero. I cannot ever remember admitting somebody else was right. I suggested it might be a useful skill to learn if she wanted to have a happy marriage. I told her that I'd found it a great addition to my own communication repertoire. On the occasions when I said, you're right in my own marriage, I noticed that Kathleen responded as if she were hearing the sweet sounds of a Mozart concerto. Lois and her husband came in for a session together. It turned out that he not only loved her very much, but was also very intimidated by her. To make up for his perceived inadequacy, he wanted to impress her in the area of her own expertise. So this muddled intention had caused him to present this stock tip he'd heard as if it were a sure thing. And like many other muddled intentions, it produced the opposite effect. Toward the end of our session, I asked a question that can shine a light on an upper limit problem. Lois, I said, why do you think this money incident happened at this particular time in your life? There was a long silence. Finally, she said, I think I got happier than I ever imagined I could be. And then some part of me reared up and grabbed me, some part of me that didn't think I deserved it. I created this drama with Larry to find something wrong with him, to give me an excuse to end the relationship, and all because I think I don't deserve to be this happy. So I said, let's make a new deal between you and the universe right now. Are you willing to be wealthy in both money and love? She took a deep breath and said, yes. I complimented her on her insight and her willingness to make a new commitment to feeling fulfilled in both financial and romantic terms. Lois offers a beautiful example of how to handle the upper limit problem. She came right up to the brink of sabotaging a good relationship, but she caught herself just in time. She was even able to use the incident as a time of deepening her connection with her husband. 6 months into a close relationship is about when the big issues begin to surface. At that point, most of us don't say, oh, I'm about 6 months into this wonderful relationship. It's about time for my big issues to come up and cause me to sabotage the relationship. Instead, most of us go to the opposite extreme. We herald this time of deepening by beginning to see a flaw or a fault in the other person, then studying it so microscopically that it expands into a vast new field of scientific inquiry. Here's a new way. When the big stuff comes up, ask your partner if he or she is willing to join you as an equal partner on a learning journey. If the answer is yes, you join together in a relationship of true possibility. If he or she is more committed to being right than to actual real intimacy, the answer will be something other than yes. Then you need to move on and be quick about it. Now, though, let's return to the central issue, how the upper limit problem works and how to eliminate its negative effects on us. The false foundation under the upper limit problem is a set of four hidden barriers based on fear and false belief. Every person I've worked with has uncovered at least one of the barriers, sometimes two or three. I've never met anybody who had all four of them. The four hidden barriers all have something in common. Although they seem true and real, they are based on beliefs about ourselves that are neither true nor real. The fact that we unconsciously take them as true and real is the barrier holding us back. We take them as true and real until we shine awareness on them. Then the barriers dissolve and we're free. That moment is profound. It feels wonderful. You'll remember it forever. It's the occasion of our ultimate liberation. Although I've experienced that joyful moment and have witnessed it hundreds of times, I'm still deeply moved every time it occurs. Begin by considering the possibility that you have at least one hidden barrier that's keeping you from being completely successful. And please know that you're far from alone. I had more than one. Even if you're already very successful, you have at least one barrier that holds you back. When you encounter the barrier, your upper limit problem is triggered. The form it takes depends on which fears and false beliefs you picked up on early in your life. As we explore those fears and false beliefs now, tune in to discover which ones resonate with your experience. Four fears and four related false beliefs hold the upper limit problem in place. The fears are based on specific long-ago situations you'll probably recognize when I show them to you. The beliefs based on those fears are false and cause you to have a misunderstanding about who you actually are. These fears and false beliefs cause us to live our lives out of a success-limiting mantra that says something like this, I cannot expand to my full potential because, fill in the blank. For example, in relationships, your upper limit mantra says, I cannot enjoy abundant love and relationship harmony because, fill in the blank. In financial wealth, your upper limit mantra says, I cannot expand to my full wealth potential because, fill in the blank. When you remove those false beliefs, you feel a new freedom to invent a life based on your natural genius. I now want to describe the fears and false beliefs with the intention of assisting you in dissolving and dismantling them. Here's hidden barrier number one, feeling fundamentally flawed. a feeling that I'm fundamentally flawed in some way. That's how one of my clients, Carl, described the barrier of feeling fundamentally flawed, and we can use his phrase as a definitive example of this most pervasive of the hidden barriers. Let's dismantle it piece by piece so you can see how it got a grip on Carl. Find out if this story resonates with your own. His upper limit mantra went like this: I cannot expand to my full creative genius because something is fundamentally wrong with me. If you have a deep old feeling that there's something wrong, bad, or flawed about you, you'll find yourself grappling with that issue every time you break through to greater love and financial abundance. When you surpass your upper limit thermostat setting, a little voice admonishes you from deep within your mind. It says, you shouldn't be this happy or rich or creative because you're fundamentally flawed. This thought creates cognitive dissonance. The mind rattle that occurs when you try to hold two opposing thoughts at the same time. Given that I am fundamentally flawed or wrong or bad, how can I possibly be this rich, happy, or creative? The cognitive dissonance must be resolved in one of two ways: by returning to your previous thermostat setting, or by letting go of the old limiting belief, which allows you to stabilize at the new higher level. The best way is to shine the light of awareness on the thought that you are fundamentally flawed and label it as what it is, an upper limit bug. I use bug in two senses here. It's like a computer bug because it's a false line in your code that causes a breakdown in your operating efficiency. It's like a bug in the mosquito sense, too, because it bites you when you're going to higher levels of love, abundance, and creativity. You start slapping at the bug and bring yourself back down to your previous level. The other way to stop the cognitive dissonance is to pull back from your success and not challenge the false belief. This move brings you back down into a zone you're familiar with. The bug wins and you lose. In Carl's case, it was easy to see where he picked up his bug, that feeling of being fundamentally flawed. He'd started out his life as the first child of a powerful executive who would go on to run two different Fortune 500 companies. When my client was just out of diapers, though, his parents split up and got into an epic battle over money, a conflict that went on for years. His father remarried and started another family, so Carl's early life was spent shuttling back and forth between these hostile forces. Later, in a moment of alcohol-induced candor, his father confessed to Carl that he could never look at Carl without simultaneously feeling hatred for Carl's mother. The father here had convicted Carl of a crime Carl couldn't understand or name. All he knew was that his father looked at him differently than he looked at his younger half-brother. Carl unconsciously convicted himself of that crime, too. Years later, he would tell me, quote, I figured if he looked at me that way, I must have done something wrong, but I could never get anybody to tell me exactly what I'd done. The next point I'm going to make is crucial. The invisible crime for which Carl was serving time had absolutely nothing to do with Carl. The father would have felt the same way about any child who occupied that role. You can see, though, how Carl and the rest of us who've been in similar situations would take it personally. After all, he was the one receiving the looks of misplaced hatred from his father. At 2 years of age, or 5 or 15, Carl had no way of knowing that the look was directed primarily at his mother. He had no way of knowing that he was completely innocent of the crime of which he'd been convicted. The fear of being fundamentally flawed brings with it a related fear. It's the fear that if you did make a full commitment to living in your zone of genius, you might fail. It's the belief that even your genius is flawed, and that if you expressed it in a big way, it still wouldn't be good enough. This belief tells you to play it safe and stay small. That way, if you fail, at least you fail small. Now look with me at hidden barrier number 2, disloyalty and abandonment. When we're stuck behind the barrier of disloyalty and abandonment, our unconscious mantra goes like this. I cannot expand to my full success because it would cause me to end up all alone, be disloyal to my roots, and leave behind people from my past. If you're wondering what kind of person might have a barrier like this, I can tell you, my kind of person for one. This barrier caused me much consternation earlier in my life, and even now it still flickers through my mind from time to time. I'll tell you more about my story in a moment, but for now, focus on whether this barrier has shown up in your life. Here are two questions that can help you discover if you too have this barrier. Did I break the family's spoken or unspoken rules to get where I am? And a second question, even though I'm successful, did I fail to meet the expectations my parents had of me? If you answered yes to either of these questions, you're likely to feel guilty later in life as you expand into more and more success. You're likely to feel at a deep and unconscious level that your quest for a life of your own and success on your own terms has come at the cost of leaving behind your roots and being disloyal to those who loved you. The guilt you feel makes you put on the brakes, holding yourself back from ultimate success and keeping you from enjoying the success you already have. You follow breakthroughs of success with bouts of self-punishment. Here's a vivid example of hidden barrier number two in action. I counseled a newlywed couple just after they'd had a memorable encounter with this barrier. Robert had just finished his medical residency. Dee was an administrator at the university where Robert had received his MD. Their backgrounds could not have been more different. Robert was from an old money family in New England, whereas Dee had been raised in a hippie enclave near Santa Cruz by a single mom. Robert's family didn't approve of Dee because she was 5 years older than Robert and didn't come from an aristocratic stock. They probably would have disapproved even more had they known that Dee's mother also made her living by growing exotic herbs, some of which are illegal to possess. Nevertheless, Robert and Dee were deeply in love, and preliminary plans were made for a big fancy wedding at the estate of Robert's family. On the insistence of Robert's family, the wedding was not to take place until after Robert got his first job as a physician. Well, in a mood of euphoria the day Robert completed his residency, they made a snap decision to do things their own way. They drove up to Reno, Nevada, and got married in a wedding chapel. And without even pausing for lunch, they turned the car around and headed back toward Santa Cruz. Dee's mother, Dorothy, was delighted when they called her with the news and promised to arrange a big party that night to celebrate the wedding. Robert and Dee decided to postpone calling his family to tell them the good news. As they navigated the winding dirt road toward Dorothy's cabin, Robert and Dee had an impulse to pull the car into the woods for a pre-party cuddle. They spread a blanket in the woods and fell to celebrating their first married lovemaking adventure. In the heat of passion, they rolled off the blanket into a bed of poison oak. Now, poison oak can take 24 hours to produce symptoms, so they didn't even realize they were a ticking time bomb of red and itchy rash. They proceeded to the party where Dorothy and her friends provided a raucous welcome to the newlyweds. After dancing and singing into the wee hours, they collapsed into bed, only to awaken the next morning with a double-barreled dose of misery. Not only were they hungover, they were aflame with rash and itch. They spent the next few days in and out of ice cube baths, imbibing pain relievers, and slathering on lotions. Robert, who had up until then been a teetotaler, even took comfort in some of Dorothy's exotic herbal preparations. When they came in to talk to me a few weeks later, they were trying to make sense of this experience, but the sense they were trying to make of it was not making them particularly happy. Dee, who was looking through the cosmic-colored lenses of her upbringing, wondered if the experience was a sign from the universe that they shouldn't be together at all. Robert's view was purely self-critical. He said, "I've treated cases of poison oak. Why the hell didn't I notice what we were rolling around in?" As I listened to their story, I saw a flashing neon sign that said, "Barrier number two." and when I explained to them how it worked, I could see relief flooding into their faces. Beyond giving them insight into why they'd punished themselves so visibly and painfully, I also prescribed a radical treatment and offered them the equipment to carry it out on the spot. I handed them my telephone and invited them to call Robert's parents, who still had not been informed that their beloved son had wandered off the straight and narrow. They embraced this idea about as enthusiastically as a wild horse being offered a saddle for the first time. Therapists are prepared for such moments, though, and I convinced them that the longer they waited, the more difficult it would become. Behind every communication problem is a sweaty 10-minute conversation you don't want to have. However, the moment you work up the courage to have it, you collect an instant reward and relief, as well as open up a flow of communication that will allow you to resolve the situation. I listened as Robert and Dee broke the news and spoke their hearts to Robert's parents. After the first few minutes of uproar back and forth, the conversation turned harmonious and ended up with an invitation to have a big reception in New England rather than a wedding. Now let's focus on hidden barrier number 3, believing that more success brings a bigger burden. An old belief that you're a burden can hold you back from expanding to your full capacity for success and enjoyment. If this belief has a grip on you, your upper limit mantra goes like this: I can't expand to my highest potential because I'd be an even bigger burden than I am now. Early on in our exploration, I mentioned that it's common for people to have more than one hidden barrier. In my work on myself, I found that 2 of the barriers held the biggest challenge for me. In the last part, I shared my challenges with overcoming the disloyalty and abandonment barrier. Now I want to tell you about the burden barrier, my second major challenge. Check to see if any elements of my story resonate with you. The moment I made my first appearance in the world, I was greeted with 2 big mixed messages. You're a burden, and you're a celebration. I was a burden to my mother, but a cause for celebration to my grandparents. The reason I was a burden was that my father had died a few weeks after my conception, leaving my mother with $300, my older brother to raise, and unbeknownst to anyone, me in the womb. Mom had no job and would have had a struggle supporting herself and my 6-year-old brother. The unexpected appearance of a new baby was more than the poor widow could handle, and she went into a depression for about a year after I was born. Fortunately, my grandparents were next door, both vital 60-somethings, and they were beyond ecstatic about having a baby boy around. They'd raised 4 daughters and were more than ready for a boy. I became the boy they'd always wanted, and there was never a day throughout my childhood that I didn't feel their love and caring attention. Having them next door was a godsend, even after my mother recovered and I began to spend more time at her house. This background is a perfect setup for an upper limit problem later in life. Starting out my life as a combination of burden and celebration caused me to repeat this combination often in adult life. I would have a big positive breakthrough, then immediately start feeling I was a burden on the world. Sometimes the world would pick up on my feeling and present immediate proof that I was indeed a burden. I recall a painful moment when I was in my late 20s at a family gathering with my mother and brother. My first published book had just come out, and I'd brought a copy of it along for each of them. They were sitting at a table chatting when I proudly presented their books. Each of them looked at it, turned it this way and that, and then put it aside without opening it or saying a word of congratulations. Then they resumed their conversation as if nothing had happened. I remember standing there dumbfounded. I didn't know about the upper limit problem at the time, so it didn't occur to me that this event was part of a pattern set in motion long before I took my first breath. It took me years to understand what a burden upon them my existence must have been. I can't imagine the struggles they went through in trying to cope with my unexpected appearance in their world. It's not surprising they would convict me of the crime of being a burden. So it's not surprising that they would consider a book written by me as a burden upon their world. If their perception of me was that I'm a burden, they would naturally see anything I produced as a further burden. What's surprising is the extent to which I had convicted myself of that crime, even though I was, of course, innocent of the original imagined transgression. By my 30s, I began to wake up and realize that most of the guilt I felt was for crimes I hadn't committed. I bet you'll find the same thing true for you. Of course, there are plenty of things I've done on my own that I feel guilty about, and I imagine you can think of a few of those too. However, I found that if we remove the guilt of the crimes our parents and siblings convicted us of before we walked into kindergarten, we're liberated from the main issues that trigger the upper limit problem. Focus with me on hidden barrier number 4, the crime of outshining. The unconscious mantra of the outshining barrier goes like this. I must not expand to my full success, because if I did, I would outshine, fill in the blank, and make him or her look or feel bad. This barrier is very common among gifted and talented children. They get a lot of their parents' attention, but they often also get a strong subliminal message along with it, which is, don't shine too much, or you'll make the others feel bad or look bad. The gifted child is often convicted of stealing attention from other members of the family. One unconscious solution gifted children devise is to turn down the volume on their genius so that the others don't feel threatened by it. The other solution is to continue to shine brightly, but turn down the volume on their enjoyment of it. If they can appear to be suffering, they can get empathy and sympathy from others instead of jealousy. Kenny Loggins is a great role model for how to transcend this barrier and take the big leap. Kenny's been a friend and neighbor for many years, and I've gone out on tour with him several times to serve as on-the-road coach for him and the band. A few years ago, I also worked with Kenny and his old partner Jim Messina in preparation for a reunion tour. As you probably know, Loggins and Messina conquered the world of rock music at an early age, attaining fame, fortune, and critical acclaim in their early 20s. Turmoil and creative clashes eventually caused them to break up, and trouble followed them into their solo careers. Kenny found success as a solo artist with a string of hits in the 80s, while Jim tried different avenues such as producing albums for other musicians. Even though Kenny was cranking out hits and winning Grammys, he didn't really let himself enjoy his success. When he would have a hit or win an award, he would do something in his personal life to sabotage the potential good feeling and celebration. He would get sick or have an accident or mess up in a relationship. There was always something, and it was always just after a big success of some sort. In working with Kenny extensively and with Jim briefly, I discovered a classic example of hidden barrier number 4. Although they had never noticed it, they had remarkable similarity in their backgrounds. They'd grown up as gifted children, trying to compete with a favored sibling for their parents' attention. They also got hidden messages from their parents not to outshine the other sibling. When the talented duo formed their musical union in their late teens, this early programming worked to their advantage. They were brother figures together, out to conquer the world. They could both shine together, and shine they did with one hit after another. However, when the time came to go solo and follow their own musical paths, the old upper limit problem came back with full force. Now they were both in the grip of the old fear not to outshine the other one. This fear caused one to stumble in search of a new direction, and the other to dampen the enjoyment of success with one unfortunate incident of self-sabotage after another. Fortunately, they woke up in time. They were able to spot this old pattern and transcend it. Jim launched a new career teaching songwriting workshops, and Kenny got the gift of a seeming performance disaster that had a life-changing gift of a metaphor hidden in it. He was nominated for a Grammy, and at the awards show, with most of the music industry in attendance, he took the stage to sing the big hit, I'm All Right. Thunderous applause greeted the distinctive opening notes of the song, but in a masterpiece of irony, when Kenny started to sing the vocal, the mic didn't work. He saved the moment by jumping on a table and leading an a cappella version until the mic got fixed, but the irony gave him cause for reflection later. Why had he, quote, lost his voice at the very peak of his career? The answer led to his big leap and the creation of a masterpiece. He realized that he didn't want to create more of the same kind of staple pop hits that had made him rich and famous. Those were clearly in his zone of excellence, but clearly not in his zone of genius. Although he was proud of the pop hits he'd created, he felt that they still came out of that fear of outshining. Fortunately, he heeded the call of genius and went into a time of deep meditative inquiry about every aspect of his life. In that deep space, he heard a new kind of music coming from within him, songs that touched on the environment, honesty in relationships, and other themes unusual in popular music. The album that emerged had a title appropriate to the role it played in his life, Leap of Faith. It was a massive hit both commercially and critically, and contained such songs as Conviction of the Heart, which became an anthem of the growing environmentalist movement. This in turn led Kenny to a performance moment that eclipsed any thrill of the past, singing Conviction of the Heart to 500,000 people at an Earth Day celebration in Washington, D.C. One great thing about upper limit work is that it doesn't take much time to spot where the problem is coming from. Once you see it, you've turned on a light in a long, dark room. There's cleanup work that usually needs to be done, but with the light on, it's not that hard. A hex is often put on gifted and talented people early in life. The hex causes them to feel bad when they shine especially brightly. Why would parents hex children this way? An example will explain. I worked with Joseph, a middle-aged executive who had been a piano prodigy as a child. He had modest success as a professional musician, but then quit music completely because without realizing it, he kept running up against hidden barrier number 4. Specifically, each time Joseph had a breakthrough to more success, he would be gripped by guilt and end up feeling worse than before. Even after he quit music, the pattern followed him into his business career. During our first session, we were able to shine a light on the moment in his past when the barrier first got locked into place. Growing up, Joseph had been close to his only other sibling, a sister, who was also a gifted musician. However, she died of leukemia when she was 8 years old, leaving him and his parents devastated. This loss caused him to throw himself even more passionately into his music. As Joseph told his story, he uncovered a moment in his early teens when he felt the crippling guilt for the first time, that feeling that would so haunt him as an adult. For his birthday, his parents gave him his first grand piano. Prior to this, he'd been able to practice on a grand piano only by traveling by bus across town to a music studio. Now he would be able to practice daily, rain or shine. Joseph's parents arranged to have the piano moved into the living room the night before his birthday, after he'd gone to sleep. When he woke in the morning, his parents asked him to close his eyes as they escorted him into the living room. They led him to the piano and asked him to open his eyes. He was seized with joy and gratitude. He hugged his parents and, with tears streaming down his face, sat down at the keyboard. As his fingers were about to touch the keys for the first time, his mother said, "We would never have been able to afford this if your sister hadn't died." Instantly, his joy became suffused with guilt and grief. A pattern was set in motion that would play out for the next 40 years. Now, what would cause parents to say such a thing? Unconsciously, they must have wanted him always to remember his sister and to be grateful for the 2 brief years she had graced their family. Unconsciously, they also must have felt deep grief that one child could shine brightly and the other would never do so. The pride they felt in my client would always be accompanied by their grief over the loss of their daughter. They were under the spell of this grief for life, and they unwittingly made sure Joseph would live under it too. Fortunately, Joseph was able to break free. He realized that the crime for which he'd been convicted, being alive and thus outshining his sister for all time, was a crime that existed only in his parents' imagination. Many of you may find an issue like this in your past. If so, you will need to ask yourself if you're afraid to go to your ultimate success because you're afraid of outshining someone from long ago. Ask yourself if you're afraid your success will steal attention from someone whom you've been led to believe needs it more. Now you're equipped with the background knowledge you need for your big leap. You understand the basics of the upper limit problem and where its root structure is buried. It's time now to increase the velocity of your learning by going directly into the buzzing intricacy of your life experience. Your upper limit problem lives in the moment-by-moment interactions you have with yourself and the people around you. There's only one way to get this data, and that's to focus your keen awareness on specific aspects of your daily life. In a moment, I'll show you exactly where to look to find those things. I predict you'll be amazed at the elegant simplicity of these keys to liberation, and doubly amazed that they've been hiding in plain sight. Now I want to ask you to focus the power of your awareness on several specific actions. The purpose of this exercise is to notice how your particular version of the upper limit problem operates. Once you see it in action, you'll have a whole new navigational tool for your life. When I was learning to drive long ago, I remember my instructor telling me that driving was more an art than a science. The key to the art, he said, was what he called benign vigilance, or paying keen but relaxed attention to what your car and the other cars were doing in every moment. Your journey in the zone of genius is just like that. In learning to live in your zone of genius, you'll benefit from making a lifelong pursuit out of spotting your upper limit behaviors. Make spotting them part of your daily ongoing maintenance procedures, just like brushing your teeth or adjusting the side mirrors of your car. Here are typical ways we upper limit ourselves. Years ago, a client of mine invented a new verb to describe his upper limit behavior. He said, "The other day I caught myself in the act of upper-limiting myself." It caught on among participants in our seminars because it puts the upper-limit problem in a practical context of something you're doing. When you're upper-limiting, you're doing something that is crimping your flow of positive energy. Fortunately, there aren't many ways we upper-limit ourselves. Tune into yourself as you read them to discover which ones are familiar to you. I'll start with the most common one, worry. Worrying is usually a sign that we're upper-limiting. It's usually not a sign that we're thinking about something useful. The crucial sign that we're worrying unnecessarily is when we're worrying about something we have no control over. Worrying is useful only if it concerns a topic we can actually do something about, and if it leads to our taking positive action right away. All other worry is just upper-limit noise, designed by our unconscious to keep us safely within our zone of excellence or zone of competence. Here's how that works. When things are going well for us, our upper limit mechanism kicks in, and we suddenly start worrying about things going wrong in some way. Then we start justifying those worry thoughts with more worry thoughts, and soon we're busily manufacturing scenarios of things falling apart, coming unglued, and devolving toward imminent doom. When I first noticed this tendency in myself, I was amazed at how quickly I could go from a couple of insignificant worry thoughts to a grandiose doom scenario of the end of civilization. If you notice your worry thoughts, really study them carefully for a couple of days. You'll find something that may surprise you. Almost none of your worry thoughts have anything to do with reality. Here's what I mean. Let's say you make a cup of coffee in the morning, then put it in a to-go cup and rush off to work. You're speeding along, happily sipping your brew, when suddenly you worry that you may have left the kettle boiling on the stove. That's a reality-based worry thought. It's worth worrying about for two reasons. First, your house could burn down, and second, you can actually do something about it. There's a good way to know if a worry thought is something you should pay attention to. Just ask yourself, is it a real possibility, and is there any action I can take right now to make a positive difference? With the kettle, the answers are obviously yes and yes. It is a real possibility, And there are positive actions you can take right now. You could go back and check to see if you turned the flame off, or you could also call back to the house and someone else check. However, even these kinds of reality-based worry thoughts can be an upper limit symptom for some people. Some of us worry constantly about whether we've done something wrong or careless, like leaving a kettle on. It's a facet of our personality. I know quite a bit about that personality type, having had the opportunity to study an example from the inside for as long as I can remember. It's not important whether you're a born worrier or a newcomer to the habit. All you really need to know is this. When things are going well or when you're feeling particularly good, you can always bring yourself down by manufacturing a stream of worry thoughts. Once you've brought yourself down by worrying, it's very tempting to inflict those worry thoughts on others. If we're in the grip of worrying while someone around us isn't, we seem to have an almost uncontrollable urge to criticize that person until he or she jumps into the stream of negativity with us. I once coached a billionaire who worried constantly about losing money. In reality, he could afford to lose $1 million a day for at least 5 years and still have $1 billion left. His worry spilled over into his marriage, into the upper limit symptom we'll look at in a moment, blame and criticism. He often bugged his wife because she bought the most expensive brand of toilet paper. She liked a particular kind, but he was always trying to convince her that cheaper alternatives were just as good. In a situation like that, it's pretty clear that tissue is not the real issue. It took a bit of gentle pummeling on my part before he finally saw that his worry and criticism were just ways of disrupting the flow of positive energy in his life and in the relationship. Since he was a guy who lived by the numbers, I started by asking him to get out a calculator and figure the actual cost of the toilet paper. I said, imagine she went on a wild binge and started buying 100 rolls every day. And imagine if she really went off the deep end and bought 100 rolls a day for the next 50 years. How much would she have spent 50 years from now when you're both 90 years old? He punched in numbers and came up with the cost of her lifelong extravaganza, which was $1.5 million. I then asked him to calculate what percentage of his net worth it amounted to. He didn't even have to use the calculator for that part of the assignment. I don't remember the exact number, but it was far less than 1%. I asked him how much his net worth varied from day to day due to ordinary stock market fluctuations. He said that it would sometimes vary by as much as $100 million from hour to hour. I pointed out that even if his wife went on a super binge and bought 1,000 rolls a day, it still wouldn't amount to a single day's fluctuation. Given that, I said, what's the real reason you're criticizing your wife? There's a saying I've developed based on many counseling sessions that revolved around money struggles. Money arguments never have anything to do with money. Money arguments are always about something deeper, and it was certainly true in his case. We discovered that deep down, he didn't feel that he deserved to be wealthy and loved, too. He'd grown up in a wealthy family, but according to him, his parents spent much of every day in a pitched battle with each other. Without realizing it, he was carrying on in his own marriage the family tradition of constant bickering. In his original family, the formula was, quote, money equals arguing. It didn't matter if the amount was $100 million or a few bucks for good toilet paper. If there was money involved, there had to be an argument about it. I gave him the assignment of going cold turkey with criticism and blame. I asked him to call a complete halt to criticizing his wife about money. To engage his competitive powers, I told him I highly doubted he could stop criticizing his wife about money for even one day. Jutting his jaw defiantly, he took up the challenge. When he and his wife came in for their next session, they both looked about 10 years younger. They'd even taken his assignment to a higher level, both of them deciding to eliminate criticism in general from their relationship. He told me that they had spent a delightful week, quote, celebrating what we have rather than carping about what we don't have. I really encourage you to make a careful study of your worry habits. I've seen a lot of lives change, including my own, when people drop their addiction to worry. And yes, worry is definitely an addiction. In fact, worrying is like playing a slot machine in a gambling casino. Occasionally, the worrier will hit the jackpot and be rewarded for something that actually happens. For example, if you worry long enough about the stock market crashing, you'll eventually hit the jackpot because from time to time it's always going to crash. Being a recovering worry wart myself, I know a lot about chronic worriers. I didn't realize until I was nearly 30 that most of my worrying was about things I had absolutely no control over. Up until then, I thought worrying was somehow helpful and useful. In fact, I believed that if everybody else wasn't as worried as I was about the things I worried about, there was clearly something wrong with them. Gradually, I came to see that I was just worrying for the sake of choking the flow of positive energy in myself. Worrying was one way I was upper limiting myself. Did you ever see the great Woody Allen movie, Annie Hall? There's an illuminating scene in it that shows how the upper limit problem works in relationships. Woody is running frantically around the bedroom, wringing his hands and trying to get his wife interested in his latest conspiracy theory about the Kennedy assassination. She looks on with patient exasperation until finally his rant slows down enough for her to get a word in edgewise. She gently suggests that maybe these obsessions of his are simply ways of avoiding intimacy with her. There's a long pause while he considers her point. The audience anticipates that he will mount an outraged denial, but finally he says, "You're right." There's a lot of wisdom in that moment of inspired cinema. If you took a random look inside any person's mind, chances are you'd find some worrying going on. If you suggest to the person that those worry thoughts are simply ways to avoid feeling the flow of positive energy, chances are the person won't say, "You're right." They'll probably argue that their worrying is absolutely essential to the correct functioning of the universe, and that if they stopped worrying, the whole enterprise would collapse. I know, because I used to feel that way myself. I thought my 24-hour-a-day stream of worry thoughts was the correct response to life. It took me a long time to figure out that 99% of my worrying was completely unnecessary. It was very humbling to realize that my worries were there just to make me miserable. It was even more humbling to realize that I was the guy who had his finger firmly pressed on the misery button. It was wonderful, though, to discover that I also had the power to quit pressing that button. Now I make it a daily practice to spot my worry thoughts. If you do that, you can use them as springboards into your zone of genius. I'd like to show you the tool I've developed. It's a sequence of moves that reliably get you out of the worry trap. Let me take you through the moves step by step and then follow with a real-life example. Step 1, I notice myself worrying about something. Step 2, I let go of the worry thoughts, shifting my focus away from them. Step 3, I wonder, what new positive thing is trying to come into being? Step 4. I usually get a body feeling, not a thought or idea, of where that positive new thing is trying to come through. Step 5. I open my focus to feel that body feeling deeply. Step 6. I let myself feel it deeply for as long as I possibly can. Step 7. Later, I often get an idea of the positive thing that was trying to come through. Here's a walkthrough of the process using a real example. Step 1. I'm walking down the street of my town on a Saturday afternoon. I pass a jewelry store where my wife, Kathleen, and I have bought beautiful pieces over the years. I glance in the window as I pass, admiring some of the items. About 15 seconds later, I notice some worry thoughts about money in my mind. Specifically, the worry thoughts are about whether we have enough money to help a gifted young member of our family go to a private music conservatory she wants to attend. Step 2. I notice the worry thoughts and